My name is David Blundell QC, and I'll be delivering this next part of the podcast, which deals with the substantive content of the Court of Appeals ruling in the Bayer and Novartis appeals. The judgment is a lengthy and complex document, including a detailed analysis of the arguments advanced by the appellants. It runs to some 214 paragraphs. The main judgment was given by the Vice President of the Court of Appeals Civil Division, Lord Justice Underhill. Lord Justice Floyd and Lady Justice Rose agreed with him. Lady Justice Rose also gave a short concurring judgment with which Lord Justice Underhill agreed. The court began by an examination of the regulatory regime. It then examined the legality of each of the four modes of implementation or operation of the policy. And finally, it ruled on the individual grounds of appeal. In summary, the court found as follows. After sending out a detailed analysis of the EU and domestic legislative regimes, the court examined the CJEU case law on compounded Avastin. You'll find that analysis in paragraphs 50 through to 118 of the judgment. Key amongst the CJEU cases for the purposes of the present appeal was case C535 of 11, the apposite case. This case introduced a narrow, judicially developed exemption from the requirements of the Medicines Directive, and in particular from the requirement to obtain a marketing authorisation under the directive for supplying compounded Avastin to clinicians and hospitals. The court held that the apposite exemption was available where two conditions were satisfied. The medicinal product in question must not be modified by the relevant process. This was the no modification requirement. And an individual prescription for its use had to be in existence prior to its compounding. This was the prior prescription requirement. And you can see that analysis, for example, at paragraph 141 of the judgment. Avastin was not to be treated as modified simply because of any risk of contamination or other changes to its substance as a consequence of poor quality control in the compounding process. What mattered, the court found at paragraph 142, was whether the compounding process introduced changes to the substance of the drug. There was no evidence that the process in the case of compounding of Avastin necessarily involved any such changes, and as such, the no modification requirement could be satisfied. As regards the prior prescriptions requirement, the court said that there is clearly no legal reason why a hospital could not apply a system under which compounded bevacizumab was prepared only against individual prescriptions, as happens in Italy. That analysis is in paragraph 143 of the judgment. The court then analysed the legality of the four identified modes of application of the policy. Mode one involved whole vial use, that is, the extraction of a small quantity of Avastin from a whole vial, with the remainder then being discarded. This, the court held, did not involve any compounding at all. Mode 2 involved the compounding process being undertaken by an NHS pharmacy in the hospital in which it was administered. Mode 3 involved supply to a hospital pharmacy of Avastin compounded by an NHS pharmacy in a different trust. Mode 4 involved commercial compounding by commercial non-NHS bodies. The court started by analysing mode two, namely in-house compounding in a hospital's own pharmacy. It concluded that there was no practical reason why any of the trusts in the CCG's areas could not prepare their own compounded Avastin, although this was more likely for the three trusts who claimed already to have the necessary facilities. This analysis is in paragraph 146 of the court's judgment. The court rejected the suggestion that the terms of the policy would not cover mode two. The appellants had attempted to rely on evidence relating to the pricing of treatments, which, they contended, were compatible with external supplies. But the court held that although the policy originally contemplated external supply as a basis of its operation, the wording of the policy was capable of extending to mode two. And we see that in paragraph 147 of the judgment. As regards mode three, namely supply by an NHS pharmacy in one NHS trust to an NHS hospital in another NHS trust, the court concluded that this fell within the apposite exemption at paragraphs 141 to 143, and so it was potentially lawful. The appellants had argued that even if the CCGs were able to benefit from the apposite exemption, they would be in breach of domestic law because Section 10 of the 1968 Act did not give full effect to the exemption. Further, in a new argument, they argued that Regulation 18 of the Human Medicines Regulations 2012, I'll refer to them as the HMR after this, implemented Article 77.1 of the Medicines Directive and required a wholesale dealer's licence to be in place, see paragraph 151, for that analysis. The court rejected the pharmaceutical company's arguments, which sought to limit the extent of the activities covered by Section 10 of the 1968 Act. The court decided that the language of Section 10.1a was capable of covering the production of compounded Avastin in bulk. Similarly, Regulation 46 of the HMR was capable of being construed to cover the supply of Avastin under Mode 3. If there were room for doubt on any of these points, the court considered that it should adopt an interpretation that conformed with the approach taken by the CJEU to the Medicines Directive. That analysis is in paragraphs 155 to 156 of the judgment. The appellants argued that NHS supplies were unlawful due to the fact that NHS hospitals did not have a wholesale dealer's licence. This was the new argument. On this point, the court accepted the CCG's argument that the starting point was Article 77 of the Medicines Directive, which Regulation 18 of the HMR was intended to implement. Article 77 was concerned with wholesale distribution, a term which expressly excluded supply to the public. The rationale of the apposite exemption applied equally to the wholesale dealer's licence argument. There was no warrant for giving Regulation 18 a wider reading than Article 77, and the court rejected arguments to the contrary based on the Oakley principle. That's a reference to the case of Oakley Inc. against Animal Limited. Finally, on Mode 3, the court decided that it was not an unrealistic option merely because of the prior prescriptions requirement. The appellants had failed to demonstrate that such a system could not be operated. Although a system based on prior prescriptions would be administratively more complex and more expensive than one without such requirements, it would still, in the words of the court, be a price worth paying in view of the savings to be made. And one sees that conclusion at paragraph 164 of the judgment. The court decided that the lawfulness of mode 4, namely a commercial supply of compounded Avastin, was unclear. However, the court reached no final conclusion on this point because it did not need to do so, and could not do so because the evidence was not before it. See paragraph 168 for that conclusion. In the following paragraph, Lord Justice Underhill stated that he was provisionally unpersuaded that the fact that there was an established market for commercially compounded Avastin necessarily meant that any hospital pharmacies acquiring it from commercial bodies would be bound to be acting lawfully. But ultimately, he reached no final view on that point. The appellants conceded that Mode 1, namely whole vial use, did not involve any breach of the Medicines Directive because it involved no compounding. For the same reason, this was not what the policy was concerned with, as the court held at paragraph 172. However, the court was very clear at paragraph 195 to state that Mode 1 was plainly not unlawful. Against that background, the court examined the individual grounds of appeal. As regards ground 2, whether prior prescriptions were required under the apposite exemption, the court had ruled that they were, but it confirmed that this did not mean the policy was unlawful, because such a system could in fact be adopted. Provided the requirements of the apposite exemption were satisfied, there would be no unlawfulness. Ground 3 involved a number of sub-grounds. First, whether compounded Avastin was a modification of Avastin and so involved a new placing on the market. That was ground 3A. Secondly, whether modes 2 to 4 in any event involved a placing on the market. That was ground 3B. Thirdly, whether the policy undermined the directive, ground 3D. Fourthly, whether the policy was contrary to GMC guidance, that was ground 3E. There was originally a ground 3C to do with non-industrial preparation, but this was not pursued at the hearing after the CCGs accepted shortly before the hearing that the preparation of compounded Avastin involved the use of an industrial process. So what happened to each of those subgrounds? Well, on ground 3A, the court agreed with Mrs. Justice Whipple that the compounding process did not involve a modification of Avastin, such as to take it outside the apposite exemption. See paragraph 101. On ground 3B, there was no placing on the market in any event, and no wholesale dealer's licence was required, as the court held in paragraph 162. As for ground 3D, this was said to be misconceived in paragraph 183 of the judgment. The exemption existed and the compounding of Avastin was capable of falling within it, so it made no sense to describe the compounding process as undermining the medicines directive. On ground 3E, the court agreed with Mrs. Justice Whipple that it would not be a breach of the GMC guidance for a clinician to prescribe Avastin on the grounds of cost when a licensed alternative was available. And even so, that did not make the policy unlawful. See paragraph 192. As for ground 4, namely single vial use of Avastin, this was held to be lawful, but it was strictly irrelevant to the issue of the lawfulness of the policy, because the policy was directed to the use of compounded Avastin. But again, it was plainly not unlawful, as the court held in paragraphs 194 to 195. Finally, ground 1 was concerned with the test for reviewing the legality of the policy. The basis for assessing this ground was that there were broadly two modes of implementation of the policy. One, modes 2 to 3, involved acquiring it from an NHS hospital pharmacy. This was lawful provided an individual prescription was in place. The other, mode 4, involved acquisition from a commercial compounder. It was impossible to say whether Mode 4 was lawful. The appellants contended that the policy was unlawful because it left open the possibility of implementation through Mode 4, which they presumed to be unlawful. It would, however, even if Mode 4 were unlawful, have been wrong to hold the policy to be unlawful on that basis. This was not a case where a policy itself promoted a course which the court held to be unlawful. Rather, it left the means of implementation to the trusts, who had their own independent legal advice. It did not lead to or encourage unlawfulness. It did not make any difference that Mode 2 was probably not contemplated when the policy was promulgated, or that Mode 3, while contemplated, required prior prescriptions. In short, it did not matter that one of the ways in which the trust might seek to implement the policy might be unlawful. See paragraph 206. Lady Justice Rose provided further analysis on this point at paragraph 214. Lord Justice Underhill concluded by expressly rejecting an argument that the judgment would open the door to widespread evasion of the requirements of the licensing system. As he held at paragraph 211, there is nothing inherently illegitimate in prescribing decisions being influenced by costs considerations where the evidence shows no differences in efficacy or safety. The judgment thus confirmed that the CCG's policy was lawful. At a time when there is an increased focus on the availability and affordability of NHS services, the judgment is a welcome confirmation of the role that cost considerations are able to play in the formulation of policy in a state-funded healthcare system.